Hello, everyone. I'm Frederick Deeshan. I write the Necker Substack. That's NECKAR.substack.com. And this audio used to be, when I originally published it, it was a companion piece to a long piece I wrote about Julian Robertson a couple of weeks after he passed away, just revisiting lessons from his life and how he built his business, lived his life, and ultimately shaped a lot of the important funds and managers that dominate hedge funds today. So I'm not going to be reading out the entire piece, but more dipping in and out of some of the quotes and giving some commentary. I hope you enjoy that. And if you do, in the description, I'll leave a link to the actual piece, and please check that out as well. All right, well, let's go. Obviously, none of this is investment advice.
So I went back and read what's probably the best chapter on him, in my opinion, which is in Sebastian Mallaby's More Money Than God. There's an entire book on Julian Robertson called A Tiger in the Land of Bulls and Bears. I read that too. I got the feeling that the author didn't have that much access to Julian, although to some people around him. That one I think is more for enthusiasts. It's a good summary of his life, but it didn't blow me away. There's also a bunch of articles and interview snippets that I dug up from my archive. If you have more, you know, feel free to reach out. It's funny that Julian named his fund Tiger, and he had this obsession with, obviously, the tiger, kind of this animal. It's iconic as the hunter, if you think of a hedge fund in the market, looking for prey, taking advantage, I guess, of weaker investors, if you will. But to me, I was really struck by, well, really, we're talking about a wolf pack. We're talking about this, Mallaby called it this special forces unit, right? This small group of people, very talented, very competitive, very hardworking. And Robertson, he kind of both attracted and developed them, and then also formed them into a cohesive unit. They did a lot of offsites, did a lot of things that really turned them into a well-functioning team that he then plugged into his much wider-ranging network of executives, of analysts on the street, of other fund managers. And so I think his life is really defined by his relationships and his networking and the many interactions and friendships he had, much more so than, you know, being a tiger and being kind of a solo hunter, which there are certainly investors who are great who operate a lot more like that. And I wanted to start off with the end of the dot-com bubble, which I think is this defining moment in his life. And I thought I was kind of struck. I'd written about Stanley Druckenmiller, right? And so here we have two of these legends wrestling with markets. Now, Druckenmiller is more of a trader. And yes, he does fundamental research, but at the end of the day, he takes his cues from the market. And so when Druckenmiller first tried to short the dot-com stocks and he gets burned, he loses a bunch of money, and he turns around and he goes long. And for Robertson, it was different because Robertson operated on conviction, and he was kind of a value stock picker at his, I guess, inception. And so that DNA survived. And there was in 1996, when he had a bump in the road, Business Week did this big piece, called it The Fall of the Wizard of Wall Street. And they predicted that all kinds of things were going wrong and his performance would continue to suffer. That was very premature, and Robertson actually sued about that, and they later acknowledged that their prediction was incorrect when the suit was settled. However, now, a few years later, 2000, Tiger was going through a pretty severe drawdown. I read that the fund was kind of down 40% in the last couple of years. And more importantly, assets were shrinking pretty rapidly from 21 to 22 billion roughly to 6 billion in just a couple of years. So he had to delever, investors were redeeming, and that forced him to sell out of some of his positions. And Sebastian Mallaby, there's an anecdote in More Money Than God that he dug up, where I think it was South Korea Telecom, where Robertson was basically forced to dump out the position, and the market was kind of sniping him, right, and driving down the price, And right as he was out, the stock starts rebounding. And I think something similar happened with some of his value stocks right after he shut down, where stocks, after his selling pressure, the selling pressure from Tiger was over, stocks quickly rebounded. And so there was blood in the water. People knew that Tiger wasn't doing well. And so New York Times just wrote, he was a value investor in a market that's not value-oriented, which is a very tame way to describe the late 1990s, the dot-com bubble. And so Robertson, what he was long at the time were a bunch of real value stocks. And he said, some of these companies are selling at literally 5 and 6 times earnings and selling 2 to 3 times cash flow. It's just wild. So he was really, really frustrated, understandably so. And here's the thing. Robertson was convinced that it was a bubble. He called it a Ponzi pyramid. And he said, the only way to generate short-term performance in the current environment is to buy these stocks. That makes the process self-perpetuating until this pyramid eventually collapses under its own excess. So he was convinced this movie was going to end the way it always does. He just didn't know when, and he had no way of predicting when. And if you want a good example, so Tiger Cup Steven Mandel, who runs Lone Pine, went on Invest Like the Best, and in one brief section, he talked about shorting, and he talked about a couple of stocks that, like Bookseller, Books a Million, which was, I guess, a bookstore like Barnes & Noble. And when they announced that they were creating a website to sell books, the stock went from $5 to $39. So if you're short any of this, and the market is just that hot and enthusiastic, it's absolutely deadly. So Robertson had started his fund in 1980 when short selling was kind of out of fashion, and it gave him that additional quiver and, you know, that conventional funds lack. That's what's that, Mallaby called it. So basically he was able to turn into a profit center because it wasn't that competitive. And now he said he was like being run over by a train that's going to derail a mile down the road. So you could kind of see this was coming to an end, but it was just absolutely burning him out. Nothing was working, not macro, not his long value stocks, and certainly not his shorts. And so in March 2000, he decided to shut down Tiger. He was just burned out. And he published a closing letter, which actually was published, I think, March 30th, so actually after the NASDAQ had already peaked. Well, of course, he had no way of knowing that at the time. And he said that the compound rate of return to partners during the 18 years from 1980 to 1998 was 31.7%. Now put a little footnote in the piece because it's kind of funny that he picked the 18 years from beginning to peak in his closing letter, because realistically, of course, that's not the performance to investors, although of course by the time he shut it down he didn't know final performance yet. So Mallaby says that the final performance was about 26% a year. Now, having said that, and this is fair to point out, I think, for critics, is that, of course, the overall performance is different in terms of time-weighted returns versus capital-weighted returns. A lot of great returns were done on a very small capital base in the 1980s, and then once the fund ballooned to massive size in the 1990s, that massive amount of capital then experienced a drawdown, and that's something that unfortunately often happens. So let's get back to Robertson, right? And he was, of course, proven right. And I have this in the Substack. So Whitney Tilson later did a table where he took Tiger's performance, he took the portfolio that he had in 2000, in 2000, and fast forward at the performance to 2006, as if Tiger had held those positions, and they returned 120% compared to the S&P being down 7%, which is kind of incredible. I mean, that's a 6-year period with a negative return on price. And there's, I found this thing on Twitter where the Viking performance, so Viking was one of the Tiger Cups that then spun out around this time. And apparently some of these funds just started with pretty much the Tiger portfolio, and they put up absolutely incredible returns in the first couple of years. So you can find that in the Substack. So I was wondering, you know, was this the right decision at the time? Because it's easy to say, well, he was kind of the last bear to capitulate, and the market gods kind of demanded for this symbolic tragedy and for one of these heroes to fall. Or did he simply, you know, he was burning out, did he simply lack the resilience and the grit to make it through this final challenge? And then I was thinking about, well, what if he'd stuck it out, right? What if he'd stuck around and a couple of years later, he comes back as a hero, his value stacks perform so well, his short book starts working again. And certainly his performance would have been a lot better and he would have made a lot more money and his investors would have been happy. But I also think that paradoxically, it would have been a negative for him personally because it would have been hard then to leave because he would be on a roll again. And who knows how long he would have kept, he would have stayed in his portfolio manager role at Tiger. And in reality, in 2002, Institutional Investor did this follow-up piece, and they asked him whether he regretted his decision. And he said, "I really don't. I can't do this forever. I'm not on the phone for an hour early in the morning from New Zealand. I just couldn't wake up at age 95 worrying about my partner's money. I love my life so much now. In hindsight, I might have been better off closing 2 years earlier." And I just think it's, of course, there's some amount of, you know, revisionist history going on in anyone's mind. And it's easy to say like, oh, okay, I should have closed out before the drama, or, you know, I love my life so much now. It's much better to run my own money and not have this stress. But I do think this may have been kind of a necessary for someone who's really in love with their business, and it, if it gets very stressful, like running a hedge fund, it's hard to let go. And so I'm not so sure that he would have been better off sticking around for longer, because even though he would have had more money, the lasting legacy is are the Tiger Cubs, or the many people he mentored and seeded and put in business, and of course also his personal life, all of his relationships, his family. And I'm not sure that having more money would have been really, you know, necessary or better for him. So I in German they say it was Glück im Unglück, or blessing in disguise. In my opinion, you could view this crisis as kind of the catalyst that allowed him to transition to the next stage in his life. So let's dig into a few of the lessons. And I think the first one that's really stuck out to me is Robertson had a late start in the hedge fund game. And so I thought it was apt to say, like, it's never too late to reinvent yourself. So if we go back, the young Julian Robertson joined Kidder Peabody in 1957 at the age of 25 as a broker. So he puts in years just navigating the markets as a stockbroker. And by 1974, so in a pretty brutal bear market, he becomes the head of Kidder Peabody's asset management division. And then a few years go by, and I think he kind of ran into a midlife crisis. He said he felt too constrained, and he moved to New Zealand, which would also kind of, over the course of his life, become his second home. And he wanted to write a book, and I think Mario at the Generalist pointed out it was kind of almost like an autobiographical, like it was going to be a book about a Southerner who makes it in New York, something like that. But then he's out there in New Zealand for a year, and being alone and just writing really wasn't for him. He missed the action, he missed the markets. And so about a year later, he comes back to New York on this mission to reinvent himself. And not surprised, because his personality is really kind of the person who's constantly in touch with people, talking and connecting. So while working at Kidder, he had made friends with a son-in-law of A.W. Jones, who was the first person who kind of put in place the modern hedge fund model, and he got to know Jones personally. And he'd also befriended Carol Loomis of Fortune magazine, who wrote the first big expose on what was then the fledgling hedge fund industry. And so he kind of understood the basics of how these partnerships worked. Him and his junior partner Thorpe McKenzie were just like, okay, we're just going to do this ourselves. And they launched Tiger in 1980 when he was 48 years old, with $8 million, which today would be a tiny fund, but I think at the time it was, it was not a huge fund, but it was also a tiny industry, so it was still respectable. Now, I think any time we study an investor or anybody, we have to take into account kind of the conditions that were in place. And 1980 was sort of at the tail end of a brutal bear market. Interest rates were high, inflation was high, and all of that was to decline for several decades, and valuations for stocks were very low and were going to go up. Short selling was out of fashion, and there wasn't a lot of competition, and he commented on that multiple times. And Wall Street wasn't as institutional. There just wasn't as much competition. So I think you could say it was a really good time to get started. And the next part is that his strategy really wasn't complicated, at least in the beginning. And later on, he did more macro trading and more elaborate things. But in the beginning, I think of it as, and I've heard this from some people who know him and people in his orbit, who's like, okay, he was a broker. So for a long time, he was active in the markets and he could kind of observe other investors. He could see how they'd behave, what kind of stocks worked, what drove a stock, how stories about stocks kind of percolated and changed, and how different strategies fared in both the 60s, which was kind of a big bull market, and the 70s, which was a vicious bear market. So there was an opportunity for him to develop a lot of pattern recognition around other investors and around the stock market. And his philosophy was pretty simple. And this is from the closing letter. He said, "The key to Tiger's success over the years has been a steady commitment to buying the best stocks and shorting the worst." Right? And so the one thing to note is that, like many value investors, his emphasis changed over time. He said, "When I first started out, I was a cheapskate looking for dirt cheap stocks. When I got so many talented analysts, however, I realized it was better to go for more expensive growth stocks because the analysts could project earnings well into the future. A good analyst is more adept at making judgments on growth. That's their job. Based on the business and the company's positioning in it, how fast is the company going to grow? I would say my concept of value has changed to a more relative sense of valuation. Some people call that GARP. I think it's just semantics." So I think the value mindset was very much in his DNA, but over time he pivoted and he realized, well, I can make a lot more money on qualitative insights and on deeply understanding the business and the industry rather than just shooting for something that looks optically cheap. I think that's something that a lot of value investors during that time frame went through, and it's also a reflection of the time, because in the early 1980s, a lot of things were just cheap. It was just a very cheap market, and then over time that disappeared. The market became more expensive, more competitive. Now, importantly, he was an active short seller, which was back then, he called it almost a license to steal. And at one point in More Money Than God, one of his short plays out and he's like, the market doesn't see this. He tells one of his people, it's me and the patsies. So he's convinced that the market just it's not really paying attention. And short selling was important because his philosophy really, he did not believe he could predict the market, and he really believed in the long-short approach. So he said, if you look at how to do a good record over the years, it's not to make huge amounts of money, it's to avoid big losses. And to him, that meant actively hedging, actively shorting. In the beginning, he was, I think, fairly focused on U.S. companies and skewed very much towards smaller cap stocks. I wrote about the 1987 when he got hit by, I think, for 30% or something like that around the crash of 1987. And he was very much long a lot of small cap stocks, which made sense. It was a small fund and it was probably more value and more inefficiencies to be found there. But over time, Robertson was he's a big time traveler and he loved to go abroad. He loved to look at other equity markets. He loved to find things that were less competitive. And he had a massive Rolodex and just constantly found new people. So there's a bunch of stories around what he did there in More Money Than God. All right, let's move on to the core piece on which everything hinges. To Robertson, this was a people business, right? The emphasis in his life was on people. And he really structured his firm to play to his strengths as a networker and as a leader, as a people person. So it's interesting, there's a short chapter on him in the book Money Masters, and it's not that important in the sense that it's just a short reading, but he makes a comment on Peter Lynch, who at that time, he was a legendary stock picker, but had also quit the business in the early 90s after not that long of a run, sort of at the peak when his fund got massive, the Magellan Fund just got massive and he was just burning out. And Robertson said, Lynch missed one thing. He wasn't having fun. He didn't get people to help him. And I think that's something that Robertson really did well, right? He was more of the, he was the person who made the decision. He was the person with the pattern recognition. But he was not somebody who would spend all his day going through detailed analysis and research. So he wanted to hire the very best analysts he could find to do that research for him. And then he wanted to use his own network to cross-reference their work and also find new ideas. So much of his day was really spent in this going back and forth between on the phone and going through the research ideas that came his way. And there's a piece, there's an image I put into the Substack, which is from a Forbes piece from 1996. And it shows Robertson in his office, and he's at a long table, long desk, and there's a bunch of people, a bunch of analysts. I just thought it was striking. It's a busy office. This is a noisy office. This is an office where people are on the phone, they're reading, they're talking to each other, they're active, right? It's like a brokerage, which is where Robertson worked for many years. So it's very different from, I think the opposite would be Warren Buffett sitting in his office reading a bunch of annual reports and trade journals and whatever, and occasionally picking up the phone to call somebody and talk about a specific issue. This is a very different vibe. So, like I said, he was not a solo predator. His strength was building an elite team. And there's a great section in More Money Than God where it says, working for Tiger was not merely a job. It was like joining a special forces unit. The commander made you bigger, brighter, tougher than you were before. He made you believe that you could beat the market because you were part of a team that would outthink and out-hustle every rival. So I think the Tiger was really a wolf, right? And his strength was combining his different networks and his knack for talent. And one thing that's interesting is Sebastian Mallaby called him sort of a guy's guy, jock's jock. So he was not, the people that he hired were, yes, they were smart, but they were also athletic in the sense that they were, they had tenacity, they had fierce competitive drive. Mallaby said their testosterone quotient was exceptional, probably mispronouncing that. But it was a different kind of person that you'd find at some other organizations. And Robertson said, we found that people who are excellent athletes of some sort make great fund managers. Very competitive people are very good in this business. So that's what he was looking for. Athletes, people who could work long and hard hours, who were very competitive, who really cared about winning. So it's a little bit of a different approach from some other investors. And he hired somebody named Dr. Aaron Stern, so a psychoanalyst. And so this person was involved, and he designed a massive 3-hour test to evolve the hiring process of what he called the Super Bowl team of analysts. He was also later, I think he became the COO for a period of time. This test was kind of legendary in the business. And somebody said the test was designed to show what kind of team player the person was, and they're competitive. And Robertson said, I found that most good managers are great competitors. So he really wasn't looking for the next individual. He was individual superstar. He wasn't going to hire a bunch of Warren Buffetts. He wanted people who fit into the team, into the culture, and who would together, 2 + 2 = 5 in this instance. He really cared about building a firm. Now, one thing that he realized very quickly, I guess, in the beginning is that the hedge fund structure, because of the carried interest and because the enormous leverage and scale that a small team could have, it was really the best structure at the time to attract the best talent. And I have a quote about that in the piece. And he says, like, I think that's why they're doing better than the rest of the crowd, because they're the best, that structure is the best paying the most. It's the best way of paying the best money managers. And if you think about it, like, that, maybe Bill Ackman's fund or others are a great example of this today. You can manage ultimately tens of billions with a very, very small team if you're able to deploy a lot of capital in the ideas. It depends on the asset class. But there's an article from, I think this may have been the Fall of the Wizard piece, where it says that even a junior analyst, so people who are allocated points, a share of the profit pool, and even junior analysts could sometimes walk away with $6 million at the end of a good year. And this was 30 years ago, so $6 million in the early 1990s was a lot more than it was today, and a junior analyst would only have a few more years of experience after going through some banking program or something like that. So it was exceptional money. And so Daniel Strachman, he's the author of The Tiger in the Land of Bulls and Bears, he put it this way. Throughout the firm's history, Tiger was a place where everyone was overpaid, knew they were overpaid, and were determined to continue to be overpaid. I thought that was it's pretty indicative. It's a culture for people who are competitive, want to work as team players, and they really want to get paid. And another interesting thing is the research process and the velocity. And so there's a quote from a Tiger analyst who said, "It's all about ideas, new ideas. To survive a Tiger, you've got to generate ideas. I must have called every snowmobile dealer in the country." So this is sort of, there's two elements to this. One is that Robertson constantly tried to refresh his portfolio with better ideas. So this is really different from, you know, other types of value investors. And, you know, my favorite holding period is forever, right? Like, Robertson ran a hedge fund and he wanted to constantly improve the quality of his portfolio by getting better ideas in there. So he sends off his analysts and says, okay, do really deep research on this idea. Go and call up everybody in this industry, right? This was before Tegas transcripts and expert networks. So people were doing field research. They were calling people. They were traveling. And Sebastian Mallaby pointed this out to me in a conversation where he said, that's the DNA of Tiger. You've got people who don't mind hustling, who don't mind getting on a plane, flying to another country, meeting the manager, and building a very personal network. And that works, and that worked especially well when there was a lot less competition. By the way, I recommend this conversation with Sebastian Mallaby. I recorded this last year, and it's linked in the Substack piece. I think that's a great podcast to listen to if you're interested in the history of hedge funds. Now, I would say that there is a tension here, because on the one hand, Robertson wanted his people to be the most knowledgeable on the stocks they pitched. He really wanted them to be the best on the street in terms of the research that they did. But then he'd have these lunch meetings, and they'd have to sum up all this research, and they get just a very short time frame to pitch him on an idea. And somebody said it was get to the point or don't bother. Sum it up in four sentences. So people had to figure out how to be really good communicators, how to be very effective at selling their ideas. And there's a tension there because, I mean, the upside is Mario had somebody gave him this quote. He didn't give a shit how old you were. He threw you the ball. Right, if you'd paid your dues. So if you had a good idea and you could communicate it well, you found resonance with Robertson, the idea could go into the portfolio, right? It was not based on tenure. But there was a tension between doing deep research but also having velocity and getting refreshing the not letting the portfolio get stale. And there's an interesting Li Lu of Himalaya Capital, who Charlie Munger always points out is his favorite money manager. It seems that he once was in the Tiger office for a short period of time, and he commented on this in a speech he gave. And he said, "When I ran my own fund early in my career, Julian Robertson invited me to share an office with him. He invited lots of fund managers that he invested money in to work together and share ideas. I learned the practices of hedge fund managers, including letting someone handle the shorting. It turned out to be pretty useless. I busied myself. If you're shorting, you have to trade." right? So this is a very, like, this is not a fit for everyone, both the inviting a lot of people to talk about ideas and also the velocity, the trading around, the refreshing of the portfolio. So this is, yeah, this is just a distinct, I think it's ingrained in a lot of hedge funds today, but it doesn't have to be that way. Some investors will absolutely reject this. And important to this process is not just Tiger's analysts, but also Julian's exceptional network. And there's a great quote in More Money Than God, where Mallaby says, "He was a charmer in a Southern way, a networker in a New York way. And far from being coldly in control, his mood could swing alarmingly." So Robertson could really boost his analysts. He could make them feel absolutely incredible if he loved their ideas, but he could also turn in a dime. And it reminded me of Barry Diller, who in his work, he always emphasized creative conflict, and he wanted to see conviction in his people. And with Robertson, what he did as a networker is he set up these bull bear debates. So if you pitched him idea along, we want to own some stock, he would find somebody who hated the stock and watch the debate play out. And he had these massive Rolodexes. And so if an analyst, there's a quote from More Money Than God, if a Tiger analyst pitched an investment to the boss, Robertson would soon be testing the idea on three old friends who worked in that same company. The analyst might say, "I think it's time to short Boeing." Robertson might respond, "I know the guy who used to run Boeing's international marketing." The assistants would work the wagon wheels, and the former marketing chief would crackle on the speakerphone, and Robertson will tell his 20-something analyst to defend his short recommendation. So I think this is really an important piece and of the process, that Robertson has his own, has an exceptional team, but he doesn't want to rely on his team in isolation. He thinks it's important to test these ideas against the world. And that's just so different from somebody like Warren Buffett, who would say, okay, or Graham, or anybody of that type of value investing style, who'd say, well, I found this idea and I think it's really good and I want to go my own way. And I'm not, they would never go out and debate the idea with a bunch of people. They would maybe talk about it in their close network, but they wouldn't dilute their own process in that sense with the opinions of a lot of other people. And there's a podcast with Rob Citrone, this was Capital Allocators, it's linked in the Substack piece, where and Rob worked for both Robertson and Soros, and he pointed out that both of them always cross-referenced their ideas. He said, if I went to Julian with an idea, he'd always say that. He'd say, what do our investors and partners think? Who else can we talk to about that? And George did the same thing. One thing that's interesting is that Robertson liked to have business leaders as limited partners in his fund. And there's a number of times when he finds interesting investments because he can constantly talk to them about industry dynamics. And I pointed out how important this was in 1987, right? His fund, which was short Japan, which didn't really work out for neither him nor for George Soros, and long a lot of US small caps, it gets battered, absolutely hammered in during the crash. And at that time, the big concern is that this crash will tank the economy, and that because debt has gone up so much and the trade deficit, people were worried about all kinds of things, that the economy would go into kind of a second Great Depression. And what Robertson does is he talks to all of these executives and basically gets a feel for what's happening in the real economy from his contacts. And they're saying business is great. The dollar is down, we're more competitive, and business is fine. And he comes away thinking, what he said was, things are setting themselves up for one of the major buying opportunities of our time. And he was absolutely right. I mean, he had a way with words, right? So at the time, he makes this legendary comment saying, everybody's so bearish. He says, there are so few bulls that I can't imagine who is going to impregnate the cows. So I think, though, this culture there's a trade-off to it, and it's obvious when you study Barry Diller as well, that having this culture of open debate and challenging people and getting them to, you know, testing their ideas it's useful, but it can become confrontational and a little bit political. And it shines through that Robertson can be a bit of a tough and demanding boss to work for, and that occasionally he has these mood swings. Malaby said, "The rich pleasure of basking in Robertson's attention was spiked with the knowledge that his mood might turn." And so these Friday lunch meetings, he'd say, like, "This is the best idea I ever saw." And conversely, if he doesn't like something, he's like, "That is the dumbest idea I ever heard." And so you kind of had to fight to stay in his good graces. And it's interesting because, like I said, I think there's a trade-off, right? On the one hand, that can be hard. There's an interesting quote somewhere. I don't have this in the piece, but somebody basically says, "If you bleed easily, this isn't the right place for you." And that really struck out to me, right? Like, you have to be a little bit resilient. You have to grow a thick skin. And you have to sometimes you just have to duck down and do the work. Now, conversely, one former Tiger analyst said, "The people he hired were not natural-born hedge fund managers. But because he was so tough to work for, he forced us to be the best we could be at all times. He made us understand what was important, how to find it and process it, and make a decision based on it." And one person described it as symmetrical, right? If you'd done your homework, if you had a really good idea, he'd throw you the ball. That was great. And if there were flaws in your analysis or you did something wrong, that he would become aggressive and confrontational. And so that's, I guess, just the culture he forged and the way he thought he could bring out the best in people. So now let's talk about what happened when Tiger got really big, because after 10 years, sort of in the early 1990s, Robertson runs $1 billion, and 8 years later, he runs $22 billion. And so picking small cap stocks in the US was not an option anymore. This is also the time when global macro traders like Soros and Paul Tudor Jones and others make headlines. Currency trading and carry trades and all of that becomes very en vogue. It's very prestigious. And there's a quote, there's several quotes from Robertson that describe this, but one of them is, he says, "I think without actually realizing it, we put more and more into those types of trades because we realized that they were more liquid than anything else. So we became sort of by osmosis more involved in macro." And I don't know whether, you know, without realizing it, whether that really, I think he hired a lot of people and also fired a bunch of people in global macro. I think it was a very active part of the strategy. And it was a very big part of his portfolio. Strachman wrote that macro bets accounted for almost a quarter of Tiger's returns from 1990 to 1998. When the Asian currency crisis happens and Soros and Druckenmiller, for example, short the Thai baht, Tiger is the second biggest short seller in that currency, so they're involved in many of these big trades. Rob Citrone in the Capital Allocators podcast, he said the big trade that Tiger had on in the 1990s was short Japan, long the U.S., and so they're constantly shorting the deflation of the Japanese bubble, and he called it the bedrock of Tiger's returns in the 1990s. And I call the next piece, next section, the downside of conviction. And so there are some people who basically argued that Robertson, one of the reasons why he went into global macro, yes, there was size, but there was also this idea of prestige, and that people, so one article mentions that when he's traveling, he wants to meet these central bankers, and they're not really getting back to him. He has to wait to get an appointment. And he complains that basically, well, when George Soros calls, they just fall in line, right? And so there's a little bit of a maybe a competitiveness to be as plugged in and be as involved in that world. Now, having said that, Robertson, he's an astute stock picker, intimately familiar with that universe of public securities, but he doesn't have that same level of experience and expertise in global macro and relies more on others there. And something that Malaby pointed out as it relates to conviction is that I think is very true is the value investing mindset almost disqualified Robertson from mastering macro. Value investors pride themselves on rock solid conviction. Macro investors have no method of generating comparable conviction, right? Value investors tear apart a company balance sheet and they find out what really in a narrow range, like what they think the company is worth, and then they found value and they can hold on to that. And it really comes back to, well, what do you do when a position goes against you? And as a value investor, this is not always the correct move, but generally, if you think something is truly undervalued and it goes against you, the instinct is to buy more because, well, it's down. Now, if you're wrong, that can still kill you. But if you're right, there is something to hold on to, right? There's a real value, ideally, if you're right. That's not the case in global macro. It's very easy to be wrong. It's also those markets are massive. They could easily trend in a different direction for a while and absolutely kill you. You operate with a lot more leverage. And then there's objectively no intrinsic value to currencies, right? And nobody's going to take it private, right? There's not going to be a catalyst to prove you right. If a company gets very undervalued, then, you know, private equity player or management or something could happen, or you can buy back a lot of shares. There's a lot of ways to rectify that undervaluation. And Mark Yusko made this comment. He said, Julian always doubled up. When a short was going down, he pressed it. And when a long was going up, he pressed it. Right. And so there was this idea that as long as you had conviction, as long as you felt your thesis was still correct, you stay with the trade. Now, this conviction, though, is deadly if you're in global macro and you don't really know. You know, it's much harder to figure out when you're wrong. And it's much because of the leverage and the massive position, it can be very pricey to be wrong and maintain conviction. And there's when long-term capital management blows up, Tiger has this, it has a massive short on the yen, which people borrowed in and then used the proceeds to invest in other high-yielding currencies because interest rates were so low in the yen. And during this crisis, the capital flows back. People liquidate their positions in other markets and the money moves back into the yen. So it's kind of a safe haven currency. The yen becomes, he says, it dried up like the Sahara. It becomes illiquid and it costs Robertson $3 billion. No, I'm sorry, $3 billion in total he lost in currencies and $2 billion he lost in the yen in this brutal time period. Now, he comes back from that, but it's sort of the first shot in 1998 where his currency bets, his macro bets go against him. And then on top of that, the dot-com bubble then starts to unfold, and that really then in the end leads to the troubles that we already talked about. Now, I also want to point out that Tiger, right, not only was it much bigger in assets, it also had 200 employees, it had multiple offices around the world, and Robertson was still, he was the sole portfolio manager, the big positions, he was what he called himself the trigger puller. And there's an interesting quote where one person said, they joined in the 80s, and he said, he admired how Robertson rarely worked on Fridays and took plenty of time off to spend with his family at their home in the Hamptons. He had a good lifestyle, the former Cub remembers. But as the fund and the company grew larger in the 1990s, he says, Robertson started working like a dog. And this really then leads us to this moment in early 2000. And Robertson, he's talking to his investors and they're like, what's going on? Like macro, like you're shorting things that go against you. Your portfolio isn't doing well. Like, you know, he has to explain himself. And he says, this approach isn't working and I don't understand why. I'm 67 years old. Who needs this? And I think that's a fair question, right? Like, who does need this? And so after he shut down his fund, right, he seeds the best among his his analysts, he gets a piece of their business. And in 2007, there's a profile by Fortune. Actually, it's 2008. And what's funny is he got rid of. This is what I think was beautiful, right? It seems he was a billionaire by the time he shut down his fund. And then he retained everything that he enjoyed, and he got rid of everything he hated. So he got rid of the massive organization, the fund that was too big to maneuver, the investors that he had to answer to. And instead, he just went back to the craft of investing, of mentoring the best talent. He was still sitting in on meetings. He had all these funds that were often housed in his office in the beginning. He was talking to everybody. He traveled the world. He had his network. He basically did everything that he still loved. And Fortune said that his personal account basically went up 5x between 2000 and 2008, including in 2007, he was up 76%. He bought a bunch of credit default swaps on subprime securities. So basically he's back in the legendary trades, but he's no longer the headlines. All the stress is gone. And he's sort of amazed. He's like, I think this is the best month I've ever had. Like, he's kind of having a blast. And so I think that's why I stand by the idea that, you know, it was ultimately a good thing for him to go through this, not for his investors, but for him personally, to go through this experience of everything going against him and allowing him to let go of this massive fund and saying, huh, I might as well just manage my own stuff and hang out with the people, do what I love, hang out, practice investing, and spend time with my favorite people, and work on his legacy through philanthropy and mentoring. So those are the things I took away from Julian Robertson's life. I hope you enjoyed this. And check out the Substack if you haven't already done so. All right, take care.